Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Right now in prison, there's an inmate. We'll call him Robert Johnson. It's obviously not his real name, but he's serving 10 years for possession and distribution of cocaine. It was his first offense. He was nonviolent, but he got 10 years and not a single day less. Well, Nancy Gertner was the judge who put him there. She's since retired from the federal bench. She's a frequent guest with us here at Radio Boston. And she says that Johnson is just one of hundreds of men and women she has sentenced in her 17-year judicial career. And now she says she's working to get some of them out. Judge Gertner joins us in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
It's great to be here.
So we're going to talk about why you're working to get some of these inmates out. But first, tell us more about this one that we started with. Again, we're just calling him Robert Johnson.
Right.
Tell us about his case.
Well, the sentencing, federal sentencing, was driven 100% by two factors. Not 100%, largely by two factors. One was the quantity of drugs, and the other was criminal record. So the first thing I'm doing is going through all of the cases in which somebody had essentially no criminal record. What do you mean by the quantity of drugs? Well, you'd think that rationally, the amount of drugs that someone had might suggest that they were dealing a lot. But so many of the cases I saw, the police sat on the corner and watched him deal every day to get to the mandatory minimum. In other words, it was within police enforcement strategy to get the numbers to a point that would trigger a 5-year mandatory minimum or a 10-year mandatory minimum.
But no, so, when you're saying the numbers, you mean like the amount
the
that
quantity,
he had in his
that's
possession?
Right. That's okay. Right. I mean, you think about what are the ways that you might care about quantity? Well, I mean, if someone is living off of drugs and has a Porsche and is living on, you know, in Back Bay, that would be one thing. But if someone wakes up every morning, rolls out of bed, is himself addicted, as the vast majority of the people I sentenced were, rolls out of bed, deals crack, because in fact he was kicked out of school in the 10th grade or the 11th grade. Also, vast numbers of the people I sentenced were in that category. You can say that he did something wrong, but not 10 years worth of wrong.
So are you saying that in the case of this particular inmate, that the case that was presented before you, that officers actually watched him until they were sure he had enough in possession to trigger the mandatory minimum and then arrested him?
I'm not saying, although I had my suspicions, that the quantity was a function of how many, you know, that someone had in mind getting it to the mandatory minimum. I don't have that information because it didn't matter. It didn't matter. All that mattered was that they could say, I was on that corner, I have wiretaps, or the cooperator said that he was on that corner and he dealt 28 grams on these days, and therefore the mandatory minimum of a certain amount, not 28 grams, but for more than that, would be triggered. Do I believe that, in fact, law enforcement strategy was pivoting around the mandatory minimums? Yes, because it was an easy way to get someone away for a long time. If the U.S. attorney was in front of me now, as they often said, they would say to me, well, I know he looks like he's a first offender. I know you think that, Judge, but I have information that this is a gang guy. Uh-huh. And he would say, trust us that we're making these mandatory minimum decisions in the appropriate way. And I literally said in court, I don't do trust you, right? We don't have a system in which I'm supposed to cede my discretion to you. But if he hit the appropriate quantity that triggered the mandatory minimum, there was nothing I
could
do.
You didn't have a choice.
There was nothing I can do. And the irony is I'm going through all my sentences. It's hundreds of men, largely men, that I sentenced. And I'm mostly dealing with mandatory minimums because, candidly, I departed downward to the mandatory. I went as low as I could go in all of these cases and did. And now we're dealing with people who just got stuck in a nightmare sentencing structure.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, as you just said, this happened hundreds of times
right,
when you
right,
were sitting on the federal right. bench. Before we get into more of sort of the policy and the justice questions, you obviously feel very, very strongly about this. How did you feel in the moments that you actually had to hand down these sentences again and again and again?
You know, it's interesting. As a judge, you can keep in your head a sense that it's unfair, but that makes it very hard to judge. In other words, I was a defense lawyer, so I got on the bench, and the first time I had to hand one of these sentences down, I went, surely there must be something I can do. and there was not. It would have been easier over those 17 years to have reached a point, as I think others did, to say, well, Congress did this, I have no choice. You know, Congress did this, I have no responsibility. But I actually thought that I had responsibility, if not the responsibility to do something about the sentence, at least the responsibility to say something about it. And so even when I was a judge, I kid around with my clerks. I would have what I described as an oy footnote, right? It goes like this. First Circuit and the Congress require me to sentence you to X, and therefore I do. Footnote. Oy, is this ridiculous? And I would have an ongoing commentary in open court and in decisions about the unfairness of it. What I never expected is that the world would catch up. We really did not expect anyone to be paying attention to these people, to the people we were sentencing. That has really been an extraordinary thing over the past couple of years.
I want to talk about that in just a second. But you did write about this in the Boston Globe.
Yes.
And there was a line that really caught my eye. And I want to know if I'm interpreting it correctly. Did you write that you stepped down from the bench in part because of what mandatory minimums were requiring you to do as a judge?
Because I wanted to speak about it. Because I wanted to speak about it. And while I did to a degree as a judge...
You couldn't while you were on the bench.
I could not. Okay. I mean, I did what I could, but candidly, every time I spoke out, I felt that it made it even more likely that my efforts at fairness would result in a reversal by the Court of Appeals. Because the U.S. Attorney's Office didn't have to appeal all of my sentences. But I felt that the more outward, more open I was about this, the more likely that would happen.
And so what specifically are you doing now? I mean, you have a spreadsheet of names, at least, of people that you handed down sentences
right.
on.
Right. I had a spreadsheet of everyone that I sentenced. And there would be, you know, what the charge was, what they got, whether or not I wrote an opinion. I wrote a lot of opinions. Then what happened to them? I had my law clerks track whether or not there was what we knew about what happened to them so that I could I can include in this conversation something that no one was saying, which is, do any of these things work? Right? We were just handing out numbers. So the spreadsheet was in part to enable me to see what was working. And of course, the answer was clear. Jail was not working. Spreadsheet was also to enable me to be consistent.
Right.
I wanted to make sure that I was seeing the same things from one case to the other.
So are you advocating for clemency for some of these
For folks? Some of these people, I'm advocating for clemency. The project is in a relatively early stage because the changes in the law that the Sentencing Commission has begun, the 6,000 people that are released, include some of the people on my list. Mm-hmm. So I have to find out who got the benefit of that.
Right.
And then I have to find out where people are, because I can't advocate for clemency unless they've had a good disciplinary record in prison.
Right.
So this is huge. Plus, my advocacy is needed, not for the easy cases, not for the cases you're talking about. My advocacy is needed for the person who touched a gun when he was 20 and now got sentenced when he was 40, and that record made him at a sentencing level that was extraordinary. Or the person who was described as having gang affiliations when I was skeptical then and skeptical now. So my advocacy is needed for the people that are not the easy cases that the press is talking about.
Well, what do you have to... I mean, you mentioned that we are at a point, perhaps a turning point here, when we're talking about sentencing reform, about prison reform at the federal level, and also maybe at the state level. But, I mean, it's not without its critics. I mean, what do you make of the fact that Senator Chuck Grassley, for example, has called it the leniency industrial complex?
I don't even know where to begin on that. I mean, our sentencing was legendary across the world. Whatever one thinks about being harsh on drugs, we were at a dimension that was so different than, what was it, is it Russia and China? We imprisoned more than Russia and China.
We have 25% of the world's prisoners.
Right. And even if one believes that what one should be harsh about drugs, certainly in this category, as you describe, the first offender, et cetera, someone who, as I said in other pieces I've written, the guy who reached the quantity that triggered the mandatory minimum because he was dealing out of the car in which he lived doesn't deserve these kinds of numbers. So That comment simply doesn't apply, I would say, to the vast majority of the people that I sentenced. In fact, there's an interesting geographical issue. I'm persuaded that some of the people that I sentenced would not have even been charged in Florida or Puerto Rico. In other words, we were dealing with very small drug conspiracies,
right,
but they were big for Boston. And so the sentences here wound up comparable to what in Florida or Puerto Rico would have been much more substantial drugs. So there was inequality in the system from beginning to end. Plus, one of the things we've seen from the Ferguson riots is that even criminal record is oftentimes a function of the level of policing in poor neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a sentencing structure that said, look at quantity. Well, quantity could mean I'm buying a Porsche or I'm living in my car. Look at criminal record. Man, that was so much a function of where you lived.
Uh-huh.
And then in addition, I'm trying to go through my files to look at other patterns. People talk about the school-to-prison pipeline. Fully, I think, 70 or 80% of the people that I sentenced were kicked out of school in the 10th and 11th grade.
For zero tolerance policies in the school district.
That's right.
Right.
So you're kicked out of school. You already come from a dysfunctional family. I wanted to say, but I couldn't say it when I was a judge, dealing drugs was their only rational alternative.
Yeah.
And we can't begin to address that until we address the schools and the communities that gave rise to that.
But so, I mean, the big thing, there seems to be a coalescing of opinion that sentencing guidelines as they currently stand do not have any room for that kind of nuance.
Right.
And individual questions of what is a proportional or just punishment. I put the punishment word in quotes. I mean, but we do have some possible reform on the horizon. I mean, there is currently pending in Congress the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act of 2015. Does a bunch of things. One thing it doesn't do is address mandatory minimums at all.
Right. It enables judges to, there's a safety valve, enables judges to make an exception. That's good, but not great. You know, it's interesting. I've do a lot of speaking on this. And two things I have to say over and over again, that less imprisonment, while very important, is not a criminal justice policy. I'll get to why. Discretion, while I thought that would have been great when I was a judge, is also not a policy. We have to talk about what we're going to do. We have to talk about the substantive programs and prevention and addressing how it happened that so many of the people that I dealt with were drug addicted. So many of the people that I dealt with had mental health issues. We have to deal fundamentally with the fact that we've used our criminal justice system as a social service enterprise,
right,
only badly. So less isn't enough, although that's terribly important. Discretion is important, but it's not enough to tell me I have discretion if you don't already give me alternatives that would enable me to exercise that discretion in a meaningful way. I teach a course at Harvard on law and neuroscience, and one of the things we know is that toxic stress at a young age affects the brain architecture, affects the brain of the children who have suffered it.
Yeah.
If we don't begin to address that, we're nowhere.
So we're really quickly running out of time here, I'm afraid, Judge Gertner, but I do have one last question for you because my mind just keeps coming back to it over and over again. You're in the very rare position of giving us insight into how judges who are currently on the bench feel because their hands are still largely tied,
right,
with these sentencing guidelines.
Right.
It's got to be a terrible, for those judges who don't like the guidelines, it's got to be a terrible moral quandary every time they have to hand down a sentence. How do you deal with that?
I don't want to make it, trivialize it. I mean, you have you're in pain a lot. And in one sense, you deal with the pain, you can say, well, it's not my fault, but it is all our fault, number one. And not speaking out, it was our fault. Or you could deal with it by saying, well, you know, these sentences are ultimately fair. I mean, what I worried about is the guidelines became advisory, but many judges sentenced under them. It transformed our view of what a fair sentence is.
Mm.
And that has to be addressed. I had a 17-year bellyache. I loved the job, but I had a 17-year bellyache on this.
Well, Nancy Gertner served on the federal bench, as she said, for 17 years. She's currently a professor at Harvard Law School and a frequent and beloved guest here at Radio Boston. Judge Gertner, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you.
There's more on the show in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.